Dr. Jackson has been the recipient of a number of Fulbright Lecture Awards. He's been a Fulbright scholar in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. And during the 1989 to 1990 school year, he was the Fulbright Bicentennial Professor of American Studies at the University of Helsinki in Finland. He's the author of many books in the field of social history, and his book Hattie, A Life of Hattie McDaniel, about the first African-American woman to win an Oscar in 1939 for the movie Gone with the Wind, was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. His most recent book is a novel entitled Freedom's Way, based on the story of a couple that escaped from slavery. And so now, without further ado, I'm going to give the podium over to Dr. Jackson.
Well, the first thing I want to say is that I'm very pleased to be a part of this exhibit and this experiment in reference to the dreadful event in the 20th century known as the Holocaust. I'm not going to speak to you for very long. Maybe you are familiar with an old Kentucky politician's statement that a Kentucky politician with notes can speak for maybe 30 minutes, and a Kentucky politician without notes can speak for at least 3 hours. But I want you to relax just a little bit. I did bring a note with me, all right? Okay. Now, before I get into my presentation, I'd like to tell you how I got involved with one of the most fascinating people I've ever met, someone who deeply affected and influenced my own life. I was reading the newspaper one day around the July the 4th, and the Courier-Journal had a little story about international people living in Louisville. One of them was a restaurateur named Joseph Gobbi, who, the article said, had lived in the Minsk ghetto and had helped to save many residents thereof from Nazi brutality. So, I got on the telephone 5 minutes after I called information. I was speaking with Joseph Gobbi, and I asked him if anyone had ever written his life story. He said no. And so we arranged a meeting. I went to Louisville and met him. And that started a process that lasted for over 3 years. Just about every Saturday, I would drive up to Louisville, and we would sit in the Gobbi restaurant, which was closed on Saturdays, and I would talk with Joseph. I had my little laptop computer, and I had a tape recorder with me, and Joseph would just talk. I decided that would be the best way to do it. And admittedly, I will have to tell you that his English was a lot better than my Russian. And so we got along with each other very nicely. Every time I would complete a chapter, I would send it to Joseph. He would send it up to his son Alex in Skokie, Illinois. And they would edit it and change it and correct it and the like. And so I believe that the final product is an accurate description of Joseph Gobbi's life. So that's how I came to write the book. Now, about Joseph himself, he stood 4 feet 11 inches when he was 70 years old. I always told him he should have been a jockey, and he agreed with me. And he always reminded me of Filipino ambassador Carlos Romulo. Some of you may have heard of Carlos Romulo. Carlos Romulo was a very short person, well below 5 feet. And one day he was in a meeting with various people, every one of whom were over 6 feet tall. And someone asked Mr. Romulo, how do you, being so short, feel about having a meeting with a whole bunch of people who are over 6 feet tall? And Mr. Romulo looked his questioner in the face and he said, I feel like a dime among nickels. That's what Joseph was. He was a dime among nickels. He may have been short of stature, but he was big in everything else in his life. When I wrote the book, or after I wrote the book, Joseph and I would go around to bookstores in Kentucky, and we would have signings. I would sign, and Joseph would sign. And we introduced ourselves this way. Joseph was the noun, and I was the verb. And I can assure you that the noun and the verb were always in perfect agreement with one another. We got along very well. He was one of the best friends that I have ever had or expect to have. Now, he and I come essentially from the same generation, but certainly we led vastly different lives. I grew up on a cotton farm in Alabama, and Joseph grew up in a concentration camp in Minsk, Russia, which of course now is Minsk, Belarus. He was born in November of 1931. He came from a talented family. His father, Naum, was an accomplished musician, a violinist, who went from place to place in the Soviet Union giving performances. They lived in a section of Minsk called Grushevsky Posilek, which was one of the fairly upscale communities in the city, and they enjoyed an intellectual life and things of that sort. Now we move forward to 1941. It was in that year that the Germans invaded Russia, as we all know, and soldiers began to come into Minsk. Believe it or not, the first wave of German soldiers were not all that much feared by the people of Minsk. The old-timers who remembered the German soldiers from World War I just a few years before had remarked upon the gentlemanly nature of some of the German soldiers. And these German soldiers in 1941 began to distribute candy bars and chewing gum to youngsters like Joseph Gavi, who at that time was 9 years of age when this invasion started. So actually, the first few days of the German occupation did not give any great reason for discomfort. They had not yet, however, met the SS. That was the big deal. And in fact, the first few days of the Minsk occupation were deliberate by the Germans. They wanted to create a false sense of security so that when the rigid orders did come, they would be easier to carry out. After about 15 or 20 days, things began to get difficult. They began to order, the SS did, they began to order all of the Jews in Minsk out of their homes and into an enclosure. This enclosure ultimately resulted in the Minsk ghetto, which was second in size only to the Warsaw ghetto in Poland during the war. Naum, Joseph's father, decided to give his apartment or lend his apartment to one of his musical colleagues. They had been touring together for years, and so Naum thought that his friend in the symphony would be a good occupant for that apartment. Keep that in mind. I want to come back to it in a few minutes, this leasing out the apartment in Grushevsky Posilek. They went into the ghetto, They were crowded, very much so. I have photos of the ghetto in the book here showing these horrible conditions in which they lived. Joseph, his mother Rachel, his father Naum, and his grandparents, both maternal and paternal, moved into the ghetto. Things were fairly quiet until about July of 1941, when the first so-called action began to occur. By the word action, I simply mean that a number of German soldiers, SS guards, thugs, went on a drinking spree, and then they went on a murder spree. And they began to go into the houses of these people and wantonly killed them. An action was the same thing as what we frequently refer to as a pogrom. That's an ugly word, isn't it? Pogrom. Very ugly. But anyway, this was the first instance in which Joseph, his father, his mother, his grandparents, and others, cousins, realized that that the German occupation was not benign, that it was a very terrible thing that had fallen upon their country. After July, things were relatively quiet for a time, and then in March of 1942, another action occurred, and apparently, as people have described it since then, the Germans wanted to clear out the Minsk residents because they were bringing in people from Poland, Austria, Hungary, and they wanted to make room for these out-of-country refugees, Jewish refugees. And in their drunken stupor, they simply executed something like 20,000 people in the first year of occupation. Well, Joseph gave me many stark descriptions of these matters. First of all, he lost his grandfather, whose name was Kiva. During one of the actions, Kiva stayed at home. He didn't want to go anywhere, and he became a victim. Then he lost his grandmother, Hannah. The Germans killed her and simply brought her out and set her on the front doorstep, so that when Joseph returned home one day, he saw his grandmother sitting on the front step. The only problem with that was that she was shot dead by the Germans, you see. And then he lost his father. He and his father were put to work in an armaments plant in Minsk, and they would go to work every day at daybreak, and they were allowed to go home at night. But one day, Joseph was released from work, and Naum wasn't. And so Joseph searched for Naum for about 3 or 4 days until he was able to verify that Naum, too, had fallen victim to this horrible event of action. Now, the repeated acts of violence against the Jewish settlement caused a number of reactions. First of all, it made a great number of people very angry. And the first chapter of my book is, in fact, entitled The Raised Fist. You can take me so far, but no further, is the message. And it would not be long until some kind of resistance set in reference to what the Germans were doing. Now, you see, by now, Joseph had lost two grandparents, his father, and he almost lost his mother, Rachel. He came home one day, found his mother missing, and he discovered that she had been put into a structure that was called the barn. The barn was a staging area preparatory to taking the people in it out and executing them. Joseph went over to the barn. Remember now that he is not a very big person. He went up to the German soldier guarding the barn, wanting to get inside. The German soldier would not let him. And finally, Joseph jumped up on the soldier's back and began scratching and biting him. This made the soldier angry. So he threw the soldier in, he threw Joseph into the barn. It so happened, though, that a young woman, who by that time was working with the Russian partisans, walked up to the German guard, said something to him, and within a few minutes, both Joseph and Rachel were released from the barn. So Joseph came that close to losing both of his parents in these continuous events. Now, the next thing I have to tell you is to show how Joseph's shortness of stature came in handy. As you might imagine, there were numerous guard posts around the ghetto. It was circled by barbed wire, some of it electrified and the like. Well, Joseph, being so small, could really come and go. He could get in, he could get out. In fact, he led his mother one night across a very dangerous city, because if anybody had seen them and recognized them as Jews, they would have been shot on sight. But what Joseph wanted to do was to take Rachel back to the apartment at Grushevsky Posilek and ask the friends of Naum to let her stay there, because she happened to be a young mother again at that time, and she needed seeing to. When they got to the apartment, the people living in it began to shout anti-Semitic slogans at them, threatened to call the police, chase them off, and in all other ways showed that their relationship with the Garvey family was anything but friendship. Joseph later sort of rationalized this, because he said that maybe they were just protecting themselves, maybe they truly were anti-Semitic, maybe they had changed. But keep that little story in mind, because I'm going to come back to it, okay? Now, Joseph could walk right up to a sentry stand and not be seen. He was so short, and it was so easy for him to disguise himself or to make himself unseen. He found the best places for getting in and out of the ghetto. So of all the people in the ghetto, I guess Joseph had the greatest mobility. He could go wherever he pleased, so to speak. Now, this partisan group, this Russian resistance that I mentioned a moment ago, the headquarters for this partisan group was in the Nalaboki Forest, approximately 15 to 20 miles away from city center in Minsk. The partisans were individuals who, of course, did everything they could to weaken the Germans, as well as, I might tell you, their Russian collaborators. In fact, many native people from Belarus became German collaborators, again, perhaps out of a sense of self-survival or perhaps ideology. But whatever, they helped the Germans to fight against or to threaten and torment the Jewish population. And I can assure you that after the war, the Belarusian collaborators did not have a good time of it. They were treated in very significant ways. One night In the Metz ghetto, there came a young lady whose name was Greta Klebanov. And she looked at Joseph and told him that he would be a perfect member for the partisans. And so she first had to convince Rachel, Joseph's mother, of it, because this is a very dangerous thing. And if he is caught, he will be executed on the spot. And do keep in mind that by now, he is all of 10 years of age, you see. All right? But finally, Rachel relented. Joseph became a guide. He found the best times when the Germans were having supper or when they were having one of their interminable beer parties or drinking sessions and whatever. And he coupled this knowledge with the places that were best to get out from under the fence. So he began to lead groups of 12 to 15 people at a time from the Minsk ghetto through little villages like Gaiche and others until they finally got to the partisans. Now, the partisans were divided in essentially two groups. One was the fighting group, and the other was the family group. And, of course, most of the people Joseph led to the partisans went into the family group, because these were women, children, elderly people, and the like. Then Joseph would stay for 2 or 3 weeks with the partisans, and then he would come back, slip into the ghetto, and collect another 15 to 20, maybe sometimes 30 people, and take them out of the ghetto to relative safety. This was a very dangerous job, but in the course of time, he saved approximately 300 people. He took them from the ghetto to Nalaboki, where they, as I say, were relatively safe. Well, he kept this up for quite some time, but then the partisans wanted to transfer Joseph. They felt that instead of escorting so many people out of the ghetto, that he be sent to another place far away from Minsk. And Joseph refused at first. He said that this would mean a separation from his mother, Rachel, and a separation from his little brother, Leba. And he did not wish to do it. But they gave him permission to go get his mother and his little brother. And first of all, he took Rachel back. In one of the groups that he escorted out of the ghetto was his mother, Rachel. She came only because Joseph had to promise her that he would come back to Minsk and get Leva, the little baby. And he did. On the way to Nalaboki Forest, he was taking Leva, just an infant, there came a fierce rainstorm first, and then a German patrol second, and Joseph lay on top of Leva to keep him from crying or making a sound. And when Joseph got off of Leva, he found that Leva was completely blue. He had been suffocating. And it took a great many minutes for Leva to come back around and the like. But he did finally get Leva to the Nalaboki Forest, the partisans, and then he agreed to this transfer some 100 or so miles away. When he went to the second encampment, he was a reconnaissance person. He no longer escorted people from the Minsk ghetto. On the he did this. He took dynamite and he blew up railroad tracks, particularly when he knew that a train was about 2 or 3 miles away. He trailed a collaborationist newspaper editor, and reported to the partisans his daily activities, and the partisans, of course, took care of the newspaper reporter very quickly. Now, about 1944, the middle of 1944, for all practical purposes, the war in Russia had ended. That was the same as in England. It had pretty well ended at that time. It was only France and Germany still active. But Joseph came home after serving some 3 to 4 years, first as an escort and then as a partisan fighter. He missed his childhood, you know. When he came home from the war in 1944, he was all of 13 years of age. He did not have what one would normally call a childhood. He was a seasoned veteran and a hero, actually, of the Soviet Union. He was given medals that he told me were heavier than he was. He said every time he put them on, he started falling forward and the like. They were so heavy. The first thing Joseph did when he got back to Minsk was to take a submarine gun, a submachine gun, which was as big as he was, and he ran over to Khrushchevsky Posilek. So I'm getting back to that little point I made a while ago. He headed up towards the apartment where they used to live and where Naum's so-called friends still lived. When they saw Joseph coming with this submachine gun, they fled. They left the apartment running. And the only thing Joseph could do, he said, was to swear at them. Said it was a good thing Mama didn't hear him. But anyway, he didn't shoot at them, and he said that he thanked God that he didn't kill anybody because of this particular instance. He told me one time that he was absolutely sure that these people were really good people for the rest of their lives because he had, quote, scared the hell out of them. Okay, so this went over fairly well. His mother came back, Rachel and Leva. Times were very poor. They could barely get enough food. And so Joseph decided to hit the road. He had sort of been living outside anyway for the last several months. He wanted to get into a military school. He took all of his medals, tried to get into a military school in Minsk, couldn't. He went to Kiev, he couldn't. He went to Moscow and couldn't. They always told him that, yeah, you could get in, but now this is September of 1944, and school started the 1st of August, so you're too far behind, and you can't possibly catch up. Talk about bureaucracies. We have a bureaucracy in this country, but believe me, it's much worse there, and the like. So he finally gave up trying to get into military school. He survived because every time he wanted a meal, he would show someone his medals, and they would feed him. Every time he wanted to ride a train, he would show his medals. And on one occasion, the porter actually gave up his own compartment to Joseph for a 17-hour ride, which was luxury, according to Joe. He finally got to Leningrad, where his aunt lived, and he didn't know where in Leningrad, but he kept knocking on doors until this person answered it. And who didn't recognize Joseph. He thought he was someone begging for food. And Joseph said, yes, I am hungry, but I am your nephew, actually. And it was his uncle, Abrasha, who recognized Joseph and took him in. Well, Joseph lived with his aunt and his uncle in Leningrad for several months, but he got tired of it, inactivity. So he went over to the Leningrad shipyards, and it so happened that the Soviet Navy had a program especially fitted for orphans from the wartime. So Joseph applied to get into the Soviet Navy without mentioning that he had a mother back in Minsk. He conveniently overlooked that. One thing that happened, Joseph went in to be interviewed by the superintendent of the school. And the superintendent, in the middle of the conversation, said, "You can read and write, can't you?" Well, no, he couldn't. He was 13 years old, and he had never learned to read and write. And the superintendent reached over for a book and was opening it, obviously wanting Joseph to read something from it. But right at that moment, the telephone rang. And the superintendent spoke on the telephone for the next 30 minutes. And he forgot all about asking Joseph to read. He simply said, "Yes, all right, you're in." Joseph considered that telephone call to be providential. For the rest of his life, he spoke about that wonderful telephone call. He went into the Russian Navy, and he began to learn semaphore. This was his first language, actually. He learned the semaphoric codes. He would signal to ships out at sea. He saw service primarily in the Gulf of Finland and the Baltic Sea. And it was his job to stay in communication with other ships. And that's how he learned to read. It was sort of the most people learn their language first, then semaphore, but Joseph learned semaphore and then the language, and he was good at it, you see. Not only did he learn to read and write, he learned to imbibe the Soviet Union's favorite beverage, and I can assure you that's not iced tea. He used to have a meal, Joseph told me, by getting a loaf of bread, breaking it into little chunks, and putting the bread into a big bowl of vodka, and eating it just as though it were soup. He was a confirmed vodkaite by the time he turned 14 and the like. One day, his ship came into port, and there was a message for Joseph Gavi to go see the superintendent. And Joseph Gavi stood before the superintendent, and the superintendent looked him straight in the face and said, "Joseph Gavi, you have a mother." And that was it. Rachel had found him. She had gotten in touch with her family in Leningrad. The family had contacted the police. The police contacted the Navy. And so that was it. Joseph had now been away from Minsk for about 2.5 years since the war ended. He went home to Minsk, and Rachel wanted him to go to school in the first grade. Well, that didn't sit well with Joseph. He agreed finally to go to the fifth grade. He was now 15 years old. He got a job as an operator of a jackhammer. He would get up every morning at about 6, work the jackhammer until about 4 in the afternoon. He'd go home and get something to eat, and then he would go to night school until about 8 o'clock. One time, he fell asleep at the jackhammer, if you can believe that. And he was hauled into court as a result, because the authorities said that if you fall asleep on the job, you are being a traitor to Mother Russia. The Russians were so paranoid that it is unbelievable. He was hailed before a judge who asked him what was the matter. He told her he was hungry, he was sleepy. She let him off, said, "One more time, though, and I'll send you to jail." Fortunately for Joseph, he got a job in a photographic shop, and he liked it. He was able to work very well with prints and negatives and things of that nature. And I have to tell you this, while he was working at the photographic shop, his supervisor told him one day that a new worker had just arrived and she wanted Joseph to show her around, orient her, tell her how things were working. And at first Joseph didn't really want to, but then he relented. Said, all right, I'll show her the ropes. Her name was Ida. There she is, right there. Okay. All right, well, the next thing that happened to Joseph is that he went mountain climbing. He was still so short that he was a natural for the mountain climbing program. In the war, the Germans had had a mountain climbing regiment called the Edelweiss Regiment, and many of the soldiers had died, the Germans said, unnecessarily, because they didn't know how to deal with the mountains. So they sent Joseph. And Joseph told me many times that these were happy days in the mountains. He sometimes was able to bring his family into the mountains with him, and he stayed there for quite some time. He began school in Minsk in between his mountain climbing expeditions, and ultimately he earned his PhD in physiology from the Minsk Institute of Technology. So Joseph Gavi became Dr. Joseph Gavi, and he began to teach, and he was a very popular teacher. He worked in a scientific lab dealing with matters of gerontology and the like, and he taught for 17 years at this institution, and then he was fired. Why? Because the local communist functionary said that he was a Jew and therefore could not continue to teach at this particular university. So, as though the Germans were not bad enough, now from his own countrymen, he had to face these horrible, unreasonable, and senseless acts of prejudice and ethnicity. He couldn't get a job. He went from one place to another for quite some time. And then he began to think about America. Some of Ida's family had come to America and the like. And so he began increasingly to believe that if he is going to have a meaningful, fulfilling life, he will have to leave his country. So throughout the year 1977 and 78, the family, which now included two sons, Isaac and Alex, they began to think about making the movement. They were contacted by a group known as HIAS, the Hebrew Immigration Aid Society, and they helped the Gavis to leave Minsk and go, first of all, to Vienna. Before they left Minsk, they had to put down what their destination was going to be, and they put down Israel. By the time they got to Vienna, Israel had turned to the United States. So since they expressed a desire to go to the United States, they were sent over to Italy, to the famous port city of Ostia, just outside of Rome, where they lived for a number of months, and where they became grandparents with Isaac's wife, having a little son, whose name is David. Finally, they got aboard a Pan American flight and they headed for New York City. And their emotions were quite mixed. It was Ida herself who told me that She experienced the first time in her life pain and happiness at the same time. Pain because she was leaving the mother country, happiness because she was taking on a new life, one that she knew absolutely nothing about up to that point, but was looking forward to it. They stayed in New York for just a short time in a hotel where Joseph exulted in sleeping, he said, in the biggest bed he had ever seen. He said he could sleep lengthwise, broadwise, anyway he jolly well pleased in that particular bed, and he did, I guess. Then they got on the plane and went to Chicago, and looking down at all of the interstates and the interchanges, Joseph thought was, how can I cope with all of this, you know. He had had a car in the final months of his stay in Russia, but he was quite sure he couldn't manipulate what he was seeing. They lived for a time with relatives, and Joseph and Isaac became painters, and after a couple of weeks, they got pay. Their brother-in-law handed Joseph a check for services rendered. Joseph looked at the check and he said, okay, that's a check, as you say, but where is my money? How do I pay my bills? Do I tear off just a little piece of the check and pay this person and then pay that person? You see, he had not been familiar with a checking system. And he told me that he was now being introduced to the capitalistic system, which he came to like very, very much. Incidentally, they owed the immigration agency a goodly amount of money, and as Joseph liked to put it, credit is a part of capitalism, so he was again introduced to an important part of capitalism, a credit going into debt and the like. Well, Joseph got a job at the Cook County Jail for a time. He stayed there, and the family went down to Louisville on one occasion to visit some friends. Joseph liked Louisville. It was smaller than Chicago. It did not have all of the suburbs that Chicago did. You could leave your home one morning and reasonably expect to get back before nightfall and the like. And so they decided, the family Gavi decided to move to Louisville. And they opened a restaurant. Joseph told me on a number of occasions that before that he had never even eaten in very many restaurants, maybe once or twice in his whole life before he owned one and the like. Well, Joseph had not yet completely learned English, so he had to have Isaac help him. The first day, the Gavi's restaurant brought in something like $354 receipts. By the third day, that had dropped to $55. So obviously, they were using mail telephone orders and the like, so obviously, Isaac had to come in and take the orders. Joseph began delivering these foods to various people. Their restaurant, incidentally, is just across the street from the big police station in Louisville on South 7th Street, and Joseph would deliver food to judges, lawyers, policemen. In fact, just this afternoon, I was looking at an old letter that I had received about 5 years ago from a former mayor of Louisville, David Armstrong, who used to go into the Gavi restaurant every day and eat. And he knew Joseph and Ida very, very well. Well, at Gavi's restaurant, Joseph loved to go around to the various tables and speak with customers. He told me that he was catching up on the First Amendment. because you don't speak like that in the old country. In fact, Ida told me that when they were in Chicago, one of her greatest shocks, certainly surprises, was when she was walking along the street and a fellow pedestrian would actually speak to her. Hello, good morning, how are you? You know, Joseph told me that in Chicago, he could reasonably walk up past a policeman without cringing. In Minsk, he said that every time he saw a policeman approaching him, he would cross the street to avoid him. But that was not necessary in Chicago, so or Louisville. And Joseph told me that he simply felt comfortable in the United States. He said, I'm home now. He was no longer a comrade. He happened to be a citizen, and a very proud citizen at that. And I can't begin to tell you how proud I am to have made his acquaintance and to have written his life story. Thank you very much. I'll answer questions if I can. Thank you.
Anyone have questions?
You mentioned the family owned a restaurant. What kind of a restaurant was it, and how did it come to be?
Order the beef stroganoff.
Right. I'm sorry.
Yes, it the restaurant is open, unless things have changed recently, for breakfast and lunch, not for dinner. You can get the best breakfast in town, and I happen to think the food is wonderful. Right, Ida? Wonderful, yes. Okay. Right. Okay. In the back there, you'll have to tell me. Of the restaurant, South 7th Street. Tell them I sent you. Just across from the big police station.
222 South 7th Street.
Okay, 222 South 7th.
What's the name of the book that you wrote?
The Joseph Gabi, Young Hero of the Minsk Ghetto. Okay.
But the Minsk ghetto, was it eventually everything was taken down, or no parts of it left?
That's my understanding. I've seen photos of the place in the 1950s, and it bears little resemblance to the 1940s.
Any other questions? In the back there.
What did he ask?
Was he ever in danger of being sent to a concentration camp?
Well, Joseph defined the Minsk ghetto as a concentration camp. It was a death camp because he saw all of these depredations that were taking place. He especially spoke about a place in Minsk called Jubilation Plaza, where the trucks were outfitted with poisonous gas and then loaded with Jewish people, driven down the road while the gas was being released and the like. He also saw mounds, graves. He said that on one occasion the ground was still moving when he saw it. There were people who were not dead, who were buried with bulldozers and things of that nature. So the difference between a ghetto and a concentration camp is a very small one, at least under the conditions that Joseph described to me. He very frequently called it a death camp rather than any kind of concentration camp, okay? Because the and he kept telling me about how his family cringed because they could hear the German troops getting closer and closer to their own house. Many of them built little secret rooms called Molinas in their house to avoid the Germans and the like, mostly to little or no avail, but they did everything they possibly could to be survivors. Okay.
Any other questions?
What did the Russian partisan woman say at the barn to get him out?
Well, Joseph never told me. But the woman's name was Greta Klebanoff. She was a sort of a liaison person between the Jews in the ghetto and the German authorities. There was one building there called the Judenrat, and this was a semblance of self-government that the Germans wanted the Jews to think that they had. It was a complete sham. There was nothing to it. But she apparently was a part of that Judenrat and had been in contact with certain German officials, and apparently she knew this particular soldier and got Rachel's and Joseph's release. Okay?
Any more questions?
How many people would have actually died then in Minsk from the Jewish population?
I don't know what the overall figure is. I know from the sources that I used that in the Axions through March of 1942, well, the Axion of March 1942 accounted for approximately 20,000 people just in that ghetto, and the one of November of 1941, roughly the same amount, so at least 40,000. Out of 100,000, this was the extent of the Metz ghetto, you see.
I'd like to thank Dr. Jackson for speaking, and also Mrs. Gavi for coming today. So please join me in a round of applause.